In her novel, The Good Earth, Perlbach wrote, "If roots are to bear fruit, they must be kept well in the soil of land." Her thought leads us to ask, which land is best for bearing one's fruit?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,414th edition of the Food Chain Radio podcast. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in San Blas, who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, we have been hearing a lot about farmland recently. We've been hearing how very wealthy people like Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates have been using the millions and billions pouring into and out of their businesses to buy up vast tracts of America's farmland, and how mysterious entities from China are buying up farmland near America's military bases, and how entrepreneurs have been buying up farmland covered in greenhouses for the purposes of growing America's cannabis. The true value of all that farmland is determined by what someone is willing to pay for it, and there are a lot of reasons why people buy farmland. Today, we want to focus on those who want to obtain farmland to grow food, flowers, and fiber as a business, to become a farmer, in other words. And we are fortunate to have one who knows how to find the true value of farmland for a business. Please welcome Chuck Allen of Chuck Allen Properties in Watsonville, California. Welcome back, Chuck.
Thank you. Good morning, Michael. Thank you very much.
Great to have you aboard. Both the Wall Street Journal and Keller Williams list you as one of the top real estate producers in the nation. That's a pretty big deal. You're selling ag real estate in the Pajaro and Salinas Valleys, which is some of the most productive farmland in the world, at least in terms of dollars per acre per year. Is your real estate practice a bit like selling mansions in Beverly Hills?
Well, we are probably the highest valued farmland in the United States, and my observations, largely because of the long growing season that we have and the mild, moderate climate that we're all blessed with and hopefully don't take for granted.
And the kinds of crops we grow are also high value crops, are they not?
That's correct, yes. Berries predominantly are the backbone of our agricultural economy in along the coast of Salinas Valley, as well as the Pajaro Valley. And the diversity that we have in our valley, the crop diversity is unique. And it's important because of multiple reasons. One is it's necessary for crop rotation. Berries can't go back to back. You have to either use cover crops or use alternative produce cropping behind a berry crop.
And the reason they can't be grown in back-to-back years is?
Well, each crop will have its own set of problems as far as buildup of viruses or nematodes and what have you. And so by using a rotation, you'll dispense with many of those enemies of the berry.
Common practice for millenniums is to rotate crops.
That's correct. Yes,
it does. It makes a lot of sense in high density, high value crops like berries and whatnot are grown in the Central Coast here. Salad bowl of the world.
That's right. Yeah, and where lettuce back in the 40s, 50s, 60s was the predominant crop in lettuce and apples. Today, each of those crops are very important, but they're not predominant. And the lettuce, as we know, they're still growing head lettuce, but there's now a predominance of leafy lettuces that are grown and harvested as almost baby lettuces, just like spinach is also grown that way. And so they become a rotation crop and can pay much. They can't pay the same rate, lease rate, as a berry crop can pay because of the value of the commodity.
That's certainly a consideration when you're considering the value and the price of farmland.
And some growers, berry growers, choose to not rotate with other produce growers, but they choose to put a cover crop in the berry crop, and then we'll let that grow to maturity and disc it in and add organic humus to their soil and do it that way. Because it's been said that compaction is also another factor that affects a crop, and it's sometimes cheaper to work with a cover crop than it would be to come in after a celery or cauliflower crop has been harvested and deal with the compaction.
So in using a cover crop, you can both enrich the soil and improve its texture and improve the growing conditions for the following year. So
that's correct, yes.
All of which is factored into the price of farmland when it gets right down to it. Well, you know, Chuck, the last time we spoke together was way back in episode number 1007, and a lot has changed in the last years, but we wonder, is it true that the more things change, the more they stay the same?
Well, I guess so. It's many growers now it's kind of interesting to watch the evolution, the conversion of conventionally farmed land to organically farmed land seemed to grow as far as numbers of acres. And as that production increased, the margin between organic products and conventional products shrunk and so became less feasible to spend the additional money on organic land. And so many are just doing conventional loans. A lot of places where there's any proximity to urbanization, it's almost imperative that organic certification occur. But the conventional farmer is very important, and to be able to farm conventionally is very important also, and to maintain a balance of your hopefully profit structure.
One would suppose that the closer you get to the city, the more difficult it would be to use pesticide sprays and whatnot, because you would have a lot of people saying, well, I don't want that around me, not in my backyard. So I suspect the closer you get to population centers, the easier it would be to be an organic farmer.
Well, you might say that. There's so many factors into it. It's not easy to be an organic farmer, in my observation. But
well, you would certainly know, because that's what you do. Is you keep your eyes very closely on the business of farming in the Central Coast here.
Well, let
me ask a couple of questions though. In the news, we've heard some pretty interesting things, like the billionaires Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos buying vast tracts of farmland around the country. Is that a good place for them to park their money?
Well, I have to say that it appears that way. Yes, I mean, I couldn't recite an area that has gone down in value, farmland. I mean, And I can think of properties that I've sold one ranch. I'm working on my third sale of that same ranch. And the current seller paid maybe 12 or 15 years ago half of what he's selling it for now. And he didn't do much to the ranch. It's basically market valuation and inflation. And
so in that respect, farmland is like gold.
It holds its value through better than gold. It's better than gold because gold, last time I checked, doesn't yield a dividend. It goes up in value, goes down in value. Farmland does this, it goes up in value predominantly and does yield a dividend if you're an investor. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that dividend.
That's probably what attracts the billionaires to buy these vast tracts of land. The land will hold its value, and they can make some money off it if it goes along.
Yeah, and it depends on what type of land. If it's, I don't know if it's cattle land. It's that was what I was referring to as a ranch that supports cattle, and as we know, cattle prices go up, and I think the highest pasture lease that I'm aware of is about, per 1,000 acres, it would be about $60,000 a year. It's here in our valley.
Wow. But that's just to graze cattle on it.
Yeah, you just that's the lowest denominator of our agricultural farmland values. Mm-hmm. Going up into, well, we're talking about return on investment or cost of production, cost of rent. As we get into the going closer to the coast, out west of the city of Watsonville, or west of the city of Salinas, the values for farmland rent for berries goes up to getting close to maybe $4,000 an acre per year. Plus taxes, plus pump maintenance, plus insurances.
So you're probably not going to be growing carrots on that land.
That's right, yeah. And it's the varieties of berries that we have, strawberries, do best as the closer to the ocean as they can get. Now, the raspberries and blackberries that have been developed and are continuing to be developed tend to want to be in a little warmer climate. And so they're more on the eastern side of the valley, both Salinas and Pajaro Valley. And those crops, if you're driving around, you'll see that there's hoops on the east side of the valley, but not on the west side. And the strawberries don't need the hoops. But the raspberries and blackberries, and in some cases blueberries, do prosper by using the protection of hoops.
So a location's microclimate has a lot to do with value as well as everything.
That's correct. Yes.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about the value of farmland as a resource for a farm. To grow crops. Now, there's lots of other reasons why people buy farmland, but we're trying to get to the nitty-gritty of buying farmland for obtaining farmland for the purpose of establishing a business. When we come back, I'd like to ask Chuck about what happened to the value of farmland when cannabis was decriminalized here in California. This is The Food Chain. We will be right back. Stay tuned.
let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. A few years ago, the California legislature decriminalized the growth of cannabis, marijuana. It wasn't completely legal because it's still illegal in terms of the federal government, but not in terms of the California government. So it set off a great land rush, did it not, Chuck Allen?
Yes, it did. And in particularly here in California, we have, what, approximately 40 million people in California, which in itself creates a pretty strong market for users. And cannabis, as it was approved for recreational uses, was restricted to being sold in California. You can't go across state lines. And I don't know all the reasons why that occurred, but maybe it was for the benefit of the growers to capture the product, to retain it in the populous area of California. It did set off a green rush, as they call it. And I'd been fortunate to be a part of that cycle. I was able to, early on, many of the growers were seeking existing greenhouses that were built and used for floriculture, cut flower production, and it worked great. Many of the families that had, it created an exit strategy. They had no progeny to come along and continue growing flowers. Flower profits diminished because of imports, and so they were stuck.
Here I have these greenhouses. What do I do with them?
That's right. It created an exit opportunity, and many of them did quite well. And I was pleased to be able to sell several. I know one family that was, we got a very good price for their greenhouse, and they were able to trade into their farmland that they could grow commodities. And they were particularly, their market was the food-to-table market, where they delivered boxes of produce throughout the Monterey Peninsula. And they just was just a Cinderella story, actually. But the rush for and I have to say that because of the anticipation of these high profits, that I mean, when we started, cannabis was $2,000 a pound, and people were just going crazy in all directions, spending money on the rehabilitation, spending money on the facilities, and investing. Many investors put money in, thinking it was never going to go anyplace but up. And in fact, the whole industry was a rush to the bottom. And today, we've gone from, what year was that, 2016, 15, something like that. And today, the commodity is like $375 a pound.
From 2000 to 375, it's quite a collapse of the market there.
Yes, right. And market rates, we were leasing greenhouse space at $1.25 a square foot per month, plus taxes, plus maintenance, plus insurances. And now we're down to as low as 10 cents a square foot per month.
Ooh.
Many of them, growers installed huge amounts of lighting and to stimulate the plant growth, and also huge amounts of blackout curtains and transformers to run the lighting. Many of the facilities have 4,000 amp transformers. And guess what? They can't afford to pay the electricity costs now.
Wow.
Those transformers. And so What's gravitating now is, and each county has different sets of rules. And some, like Monterey County, doesn't allow any outside growing. They call it outside growing if you don't use lights, even though it's in a greenhouse. But as far as growing outside San Benito County, to some extent, Santa Cruz County allows it because it's a small percentage of the total acreage. But San Benito County now has their designated their green zone by zoning, and they are growing cannabis outside and harvesting, much like alfalfa. And it's taken those prices over there in the San Juan Bautista, Hollister area from typically $1,100 an acre, which is what the lettuce, baby lettuce growers pay, to maybe $5,000 an acre. So that's occurring as we speak. That's been the transition because of the costs of, relatively speaking, that's a low cost when you compare it with the cost of a greenhouse, growing in a greenhouse. That's
a very interesting conflict being set up then between two neighboring counties, Monterey County, which does not allow for outdoor production of cannabis. Therefore, you must grow cannabis in very expensive greenhouses.
Yes, right. Right.
And then, right next door in San Benito County, you can grow it outside.
Yeah. And the taxation formulas have an effect also. Monterey County requires you to pay your tax on the anticipated. They actually measure the plant-to-plant area, and you prepay a tax in anticipation of that harvest. In San Benito County, they're not even charging a tax. So that's another allure that's occurring.
I don't know if I would be betting on cannabis cultivation in Monterey County. I see on your listings here in the Salinas Valley have a property for sale or lease. It's for $15 million. And it's greenhouses. But what is the market for that now?
It's soft. That's a daily challenge, is trying to find users. Now, there I say that even with this diminished market, there are niche growers. Some growers are seeking greenhouses to be a nursery to grow baby plants and sell what they call
starts.
Teens, a plant that's grown up beyond a fledgling stage, and they sell profitably. And it doesn't take that much electricity to run lights, nor does it take blackout curtains. So that's another form. Another just drying the cannabis. There's some facilities, such as a couple of Apple cold storage facilities have been converted to drying spaces, and they're just renting those to people to raise the crop somewhere and then bring it to the building, and which has a lot of fans and dehumidifiers, and to dry the product.
Right.
So that's
lots of different uses.
And I have to say, the industrial properties that we have in this city, we have limited supply, but that indoor grow also absorbed a fair amount of space. Now, you can imagine the amount of electricity you have to use if you're growing inside a building, but that has also diminished to a point where now there's a surplus of industrial properties that are seeking tenants. And it's not the cannabis people that are
right. They're
picking those up.
So it's kind of much, or pretty much, it's of a boom and bust cycle for the cannabis world. When everybody was anticipating those thousands of dollars per pound prices. Everybody was, boy, this is a surefire bet. And then when all of the cannabis came in, the demand wasn't quite the extent that supported those prices. Poof.
Yeah.
Away we go.
I have a large facility, a very large facility for sale right now, or lease. And it's out west of Watsonville. It's, as we'd probably commonly know, as the Kitayama Nursery.
Oh.
They were the largest rose growers in the nation at one time. And so we have those greenhouses and packing buildings. There's 1,800,000 square feet there. And we have about 100,000 square feet. So that property it's about 50% leased. We have an herb grower. We have a flower grower still, the only flower grower that's a big commercial flower grower growing greens predominantly and some flowers in the nation.
And it could be noted that the Pajaro Valley was once the rose growing capital.
That's right. That's what produced all of these greenhouses.
Really?
And we have some cannabis also. So
I always thought that one of the great ironies was the federal government talked the people in Colombia out of growing pot, instead talked them into growing flowers. And so the Colombians pretty much took over the flower industry of the nation because it's cheaper to fly roses from Colombia to the East Coast than it is from the Central Coast of California. So the irony is that California ended up being the cannabis capital of America.
So, one of my friends who was the largest tulip grower in the Western states went out of business, and he was now his job. He's a director of U.S. Flowers, which is a company probably to support Federal Express shipping. And I asked him, I said, well, this with these new tariffs, I said, certainly maybe make some of your members smile because they'll get better rates. He said, no, they're not smiling because most of my members are Colombians and Ecuadorians, and I only have one domestic member, and that particular member happens to be the one that I was referring to that's out at west of Watsonville, which is predominantly the greens, floral greens, and some flowers.
And floral greens being what you put in a bouquet to.
Yes, right. Eucalyptus leaves and all kinds of ferns and that kind of thing. Uh-oh. But it's interesting that U.S. Flowers is predominantly supported by foreigners.
Well, there you go. And that's what happened to the industry.
And I said, well, can't the flower industry come back? And they said, well, who's going to do it? The families that were...
They knew how.
And the kids and grandkids, they don't want to become... do the same work that their grandparents did. So it's a conundrum.
Yeah, which is to say farmers work in the fields, don't they?
Now, I have to say, we do have some flower growers here in our valley that are, I have one grower that out toward Corralitos that is paying a competitive rate as a field flower grower. And he is signed a fairly long lease, but his market is the farmer's markets. So he's taking field flower production right into the retail segment of the market. Works hard to do that. But that's another format. And that's most of the people that are in that business that by observation are people that have been in the field workers that have been entrepreneurial and started their own operation.
Now, is that something you see quite frequently as a real estate broker? You're out in the fields looking and talking and everything. Do you see a lot of transition between field work And the entrepreneurial businessman, farmer?
Oh, almost most of the actual farmers, not the shipping companies, but the farmers who grow and are part of the shipping companies did evolve from being field workers. Okay. Yes, it's really a great part of our
American success story.
Yes,
great, and that's quite a transition for them to make too, because you go from manual labor into intellectual labor and into risk and all of those things that make the farmer a business person.
That's right. Yeah, it's interesting to watch the different ethnic groups that evolve in and out of the farming activities also.
And the Pajaro Valley has had a lot of them.
That's right.
A lot of ethnic inflows. People come into the Pajaro Valley, settle down, start working on somebody else's farm, pick up their own farm, and build their families and their cultures and meld right in with America.
It's you can almost pinpoint the predominance of the cultures by the locations. The Italians came to grow sprouts and artichokes, and they needed to be close to the coast. And guess what? Most of the land was owned by those Swiss Italians and Sicilians. The Portuguese came from the Azores, and they were dairy people, and they gravitated toward the rolling foothills for their little dairies.
Where cows could graze the grass.
Croatians.
Chuck, we're going to have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I'd like to pick that up. And I'd like to learn how farm workers make that transition into being a farmer. Because I suspect they can't just buy land, but they have to figure out somehow to control land long enough for them to grow crops. And I suspect that you can help us out with that. Folks, this is the Food Chain, Michael Olson with Chuck Allen. He's one of the nation's top ag land and commercial real estate agents in the Pajaro and Salinas Valleys of California. Right back.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Port Ideas, Greg Williams.
There's a tremendous amount of useful information in MetroFarm for farming in or near the city.
Acres USA's Charles Walters.
MetroFarm tells how to convert an opportunity into a real going concern. Every chapter is organized around the logic of practicality. For every problem needing a solution, MetroFarm offers a progression of steps arranged in sequence so the desired goal is achieved.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. Michael Olson with Chuck Allen. We're talking about farmland. And farmland is a business, a business of farming, which is to say we're growing food and flowers and fiber for hungry people. And doing it as a business. And before the break, we were talking about how Chuck has seen a lot of farm workers make the transition from farm worker into farmer, which is to say, from being a laborer into being a business person. And to do that, first thing you have to do is get control of some land somehow. Now, Chuck, In watching the Pajaro Valley for as long as I have had, I have a sneaking suspicion that people don't sell farmland often because the farmland has a real value in itself, because not only does it kind of the value of land hold up to inflation, but as you said, it could pay a dividend by growing crops.
That's right.
And so I suspect once you get ownership of some farmland, you have to really give a second thought before you sell it and buy something else.
Yes, and that's many families, most families have been, had it ingrained upon them for generations past, that to keep the land, don't sell it, try to keep it. Under Prop 19, it's not that easy because the tax, real estate tax structure changes when there's a change of ownership, but that's the beauty of having trusts, family trusts. To get to the essence of what your question is, how do people transition from being a field worker to being an independent farmer? I've had the good fortune of working with several small growers, people who become small growers. I think of one property out here just by the airport on Buena Vista, it was 17 acres. Helped sell that to an investor who wanted to get the land rented. And so we divided, found three different growers, prospects. They all kind of knew each other, but each one took 5 acres and one took 8 acres, and they have, it's a family operation, but the key to it is that the progeny is there working and wanting to become the farmer, the younger generation. One of them is a mother-son operation where the mother has had the experience of growing, and her son is learning and doing the hard work. And the one with the 8 acres, the same thing, is a father-daughter arrangement. And so that's one way. And this is probably they're on their second or third year growing strawberries and a few little mixed crops, but they also have the opportunity of selling into the farmer's market program. And that helps them. And you know, to make a living on 5 acres is, you wouldn't think that you could do that. But if you live together as a family unit and work together as a family unit, it can be done. And that's how it starts.
And those mother's son and father-daughter combinations can then grow into a production strawberry company. As they grow, they probably aren't buying farmland, are they? Probably.
Well, that would be the ultimate goal. And I have to say that there's some excellent financing available for first-time farmers, or you have to be able to have show a tax return for a couple of 2 years tax return that you have been actively farming, and then you could borrow up to 95% of what it takes to purchase a piece of land to actively farm. Investors can't do that, but the U.S. Department of Agriculture loans up to $600,000 on a purchase investment. And then the local bank comes alongside and pays and loans the difference. The U.S. Department of Agriculture money is 3.75% interest. So you end up with a palatable blended interest rate on that 95% financing.
So it is possible.
Yes, it is.
For a father-daughter, mother-son businesses to actually borrow enough money just by virtue of their experience, they can.
I have three applications being processed right now that are seeking that kind of formula,
mm-hmm.
and working with There's a couple of different lenders. So we are a newly named West Coast Bank is one. Cal Coastal, which is a nonprofit in Salinas, is another one. And so basically you end up buying money at about 5.5% interest or 6% interest. Mostly just under 6% on the blended rate. But that's cheaper than residential financing now.
And it's also almost comparable to leasing, is it not?
Yes, yes. You have the same factors that are applying. At the end of the day, what's the cost per box of fruit or whatever your commodity is? And there's a good website to go to, the California University of California Extension Service, Agricultural Extension Service, publishes budgets, and they're not always current, but they're good guides.
Thumbnails,
yes, and you can see what they've allocated for as a typical budget for farming. You can look it up by crops, so. But by and by, I think the rent or the debt service should be probably somewhere around 30% of your gross income, no more than.
Okay, for the land.
Yeah.
Use of the land, whether you buy it or lease it.
That's correct, yes.
Now, there's a bunch of different forms of leasing, are there not? Which is essentially an agreement by which you work with a land owner to use the land for a specified period of time under certain conditions. There's a cash lease, there's a barter lease, there's the classic market lease where you, or a share lease where you become a sharecropper.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all kinds of, do you see that in the Valley? You see the different forms of—
Yeah, not as much as it used to be. In the early days of strawberries, a lot of sharecroppers that evolved from that opportunity.
Some of them became pretty big business people too.
Yeah.
Sharecropping.
I have one client that he's the master tenant and then of a pretty good sized ranch, about 100 acres, and he has a cooler. So he was able to find smaller growers and helped finance them and gave them didn't give it to them. He sub-rented some land to them and they would produce fruit. And what he was after was fruit that would go into his cooler as well as hopefully paying some of the rent. There were some growers that were good growers and some growers that were poor growers. And so he's still trying to figure out whether that was a good thing to do.
Essentially, he was becoming a grower shipper.
That's right. That's right. A small grower shipper.
Small grower shipper, which is definitely a step up the ladder in the industry, is it not?
Well, and to run a cooler, the units that go through the cooler are paid by the buyer of the fruit. And so that is a profit center unto itself and sometimes more profitable than the actual sale of the commodity in the box.
So in essence, then, there are a lot of different ways to get into a parcel of farmland.
That's correct.
If you want to farm. There seems to be a whole bunch of them. You can buy it, you can lease it, or you can even rent it when it gets right down to it. And there's just all kinds of different ways of doing it. And I suspect you've seen a lot of them.
Well, I'm thinking of a couple of parcels that in the last couple of years that I was able to sell. Small 11-acre parcels. Each one was about the same size, in the Corralitos area, And I think that the two separate families that bought these two separate parcels had similar goals, and they were to have a small piece of family farmland that they could have as a legacy, maybe build a house on it. In one case, they definitely wanted to build their home. The other one, they just wanted to have the land and come to it on weekends and work together as a family to have it. And it is a form of security. You know, if everything goes to heck in a handbasket, you have some farm land that you can grow some of your own food that creates and raise some meat or milk and chickens and whatever.
And trade with the neighbors. And
yeah, it's a form of family security, which is it's probably a good thing for many of us to consider.
Amen. That's for sure.
I have one parcel right now that's 11 acres that we're marketing. It's an apple orchard. And then the cost of removing those apple trees, because apples are not profitable anymore, is $3,400 an acre to grind them and haul them away. And so I'm trying to figure out how to get that done. The owners didn't want to spend the money, but it's a great piece of property. We're trying to think of how to transition it to a berry crop land. And
transferring it from that which isn't making any money to that which is, so that's dollars and cents issues in there.
That's right, yeah.
What can you do to pull the trees and also to transition the land into strawberries? The strawberries land is pretty well formulated when it gets right down to it. It's almost like a work of art to watch them.
Yeah, and blackberries, the same thing. Blackberries and strawberries, and as we probably have seen throughout the valley, there are more and more
hoop
cane berries. They're not only hoops, but they're growing them in cans, feeding the plant with hydroponically with a little drip tube that is water with fertilizer in it.
Sure.
And so these are not even being grown in the crop, in the land. It's growing on pots on the land. It's called,
Well, that's a very interesting observation, Chuck, because one of the most fascinating things that's happened in organic agriculture recently was that it has been prescribed that you may now grow organic crops hydroponically, which is to say, goodness, you no longer need the land.
Yeah.
And I suspect there are some very big strawberry growership or companies that are looking at taking this ability to grow organic strawberries hydroponically and looking at growing them in warehouses in big cities on the East Coast, for example, where you would never be able to grow a commercial crop before. Now you can, and now you will not need the farmland to do it. Do you see that having an impact on the future of a value of farmland?
It ultimately will, yes. I mean, you typically grow it in the parking lot of the grocery store, you know, so to speak. And we're gravitating toward that. There's a planting that was 2005 year was the first time, 60 acres over in Salinas on Spence Road, all up on benches. And they even went to the extent of putting a net over the crop to keep the birds from attacking the berries. But that was, I guess, done twofold. Reason one, it got it up where it's easier to pick. And number two was feeding it organically, feeding it hydroponically and having ideal conditions for the plant as opposed to being in the soil. So I'm working with another party that is thinking of creating a prototype of a little 5-acre parcel, on a 5-acre parcel here just west of Watsonville. That would be
another one.
Yeah.
It was almost like
tabletop production.
The more things change, the more they stay the same. Well, Chuck Allen's been a great conversation about the value of farmland and how young people can make that transition from being farm workers into farmer. And wow.
I have one thing that
go ahead.
A friend of mine often says that about these new forms of production technology. He said, we really know that it could be better, but he said, the problem is, and this is flies in the face of what most farmers are complain about, is that our land is too cheap. In other words, we can't grow it in a greenhouse and pay per square foot per month, because our farm land here in the Pajaro Valley and the Salinas Valley hasn't reached that threshold yet. And even though we're talking about $3,500 to $4,000 an acre per year,
people are still making money.
There's still profit in that format.
Chuck Allen, thank you so much. How do we get in touch with you?
ChuckAllenProperties.com.
Thank you for helping us today.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.